Leon sent Manyoro and Loikot off to some distant villages outside the boundaries of Masailand. Their task was to recruit porters to carry the ivory to the railway. They had to be from some tribe other than Masai, for the Murani would not stoop to such menial employment. Leon and Ishmael camped for the following 5 days at a discreet distance upwind from the putrefying carcass, its belly swelling with gas. They guarded the tusks while they waited for them to loosen with rot in their bone canals. The nights were raucous as the scavengers gathered. Jackals yipped, and packs of hyena giggled, shrieked, and squabbled among themselves. On the third night, the lions arrived and added their imperial roaring to the general cacophony. Ishmael spent the hours of darkness perched in the top branches of one of the ngong trees, reciting verses from the Quran in Kiswahili and calling on Allah for protection from these demons. On the sixth day, Manyoro and Loikot returned, followed by a gang of stalwart Luo porters, whom Manyoro had hired for 10 shillings. 10 shillings a day each? Leon was aghast at such profligacy. 10 shillings was almost the sum of his worldly wealth. Nay, Bwana, for all of them. 10 shillings a day for all six? Leon was only slightly mollified. Nay, Bwana, it is for all six to carry the tusks to the railway, no matter how many days it takes. Manyoro, your mother should be proud of you, Leon told him with relief. I certainly am. He led the porters to where the remains of the carcass lay. Only the great bones and the hide had not been dragged away and devoured by the scavengers. The head was still propped upright by the two curves of ivory. Leon looped a length of bark rope around one of the tusks, and the Luo porters sang a work chant as they heaved on the line. The butt end of the tusk, which had been buried in the skull, slid out of its canal with little resistance. Until then, almost half its length had been hidden, and now the true dimensions were revealed for the first time. When they laid the two tusks side by side on a bed of fresh green leaves, Leon was amazed by their length and lovely symmetry. Once again he used the barrels of his rifle as a gauge to measure them. The longest of the two was a hand's breadth over 11 feet, and the lesser was almost exactly 11 feet. Under Manyoro's direction, the Luo cut 2 long poles of acacia wood and strapped each tusk to one. With a porter at each end, they lifted the poles and started towards the railway, the remainder of the team trotting behind them, ready to spell them as they tired. Leon was no longer entitled to a military travel pass, so on the steepest stretch of the railway, where it climbed up the escarpment from the floor of the Rift Valley, they waited for the night train from Lake Victoria. Here, even the double team of locomotives was reduced to walking speed. Under cover of darkness, they ran alongside one of the goods trucks until they could catch hold of the steel ladder and clamber onto the roof. The Luo porters passed the tusks and Ishmael's bundle up to them. Leon tossed a canvas purse of shillings down to the headman, and the porters shouted thanks and farewells until they were left in the darkness behind the guard's van. The locomotives puffed gamely to the top of the escarpment. The truck on which they were perched was filled with baskets of dried fish from the lake, but as the train picked up speed, the stink was wafted away. It was still dark when they dropped the tusks and their baggage over the side of the truck and jumped from the rolling train as it slowed before steaming into Nairobi station. Percy Phillips was eating his breakfast in the mess tent when they staggered into Tandala camp, bowed under the weight of the tusks. "Upon my soul," he spluttered into his coffee and knocked over his chair as he sprang to his feet. "Those aren't yours, are they?" "One is," Leon kept a straight face. "Unfortunately, sir, the other is yours." "Take them to the beam scale. Let's see what we have here," Percy ordered. The entire staff of the camp trooped after them to the skinning shed and gathered around the scale as Leon lifted the smaller tusk into the sling. £128, said Percy noncommittally. "Now let's try the other." Leon hoisted the second into the sling and Percy blinked. 138. His voice cracked just a little. It was the largest tusk that had ever been brought into Tandala camp. However, he could think of no good reason why the youngster should be told so. "Don't want him to get too big for his boots," he thought. as he scratched his beard. Then he said to Manyoro, "Put both tusks into the truck." At last he looked at Leon, and his eyes twinkled. "All right, young fella, you can drive me into the club. I am about to buy you a drink." As the vehicle bounced and rattled over the track, Percy had to raise his voice to be heard above the racket of the engine. "Righty-ho, tell me all about it. Start at the beginning. Don't leave anything out. How many shots did it take you to put him down?"
"That isn't the beginning, sir," Leon reminded him.
"It'll do as a starting point. You can work backwards from there. How many shots?"
"One brain shot.
And then I remembered your advice and put in a finisher when he was down."
Percy nodded his approval.
"Now tell me the rest."
As he listened, Percy was impressed with Leon's account of the hunt. He made it sound fascinating, even to Percy, who had lived it all 100 times. One of the most important duties of a white hunter was to entertain his clients. They wanted more than simply to mow down a few animals. They were paying a fortune to take part in an unforgettable adventure and wanted to be taken out of their cosseted urban existence and led back to their primeval beginnings by someone they could trust and admire. Percy knew a number of fine men who were skilled in bushcraft and the lore of the wild, but lacked charm and empathy. They were dour and taciturn. They understood the enchanted wilderness intimately, but could not explain it to the others. They never had a return client. Their names were not bandied around in the palaces of Europe or the exclusive clubs of London, New York, and Berlin. No one clamoured for their services. This lad did not fall into that category. He was willing and eager. He was modest, charming, and tactful. He was articulate. He had a quirky, dry sense of humour. He was personable. People liked him.
Percy smiled inwardly. Hell, even I like him.
When they reached the club, Percy made him park directly in front of the main doors. He led Leon into the long bar where a dozen regulars, most of them living on remittances sent from their families in England, had already taken their seats.
"Gentlemen," Percy addressed the congregation, "I want you to meet my new apprentice, and then I'm going to take you outside and show you a pair of tusks, and I do mean a pair of tusks."
When they trooped out to the front of the building, they found that the news had already flashed through the town, and a small crowd was gathered around the truck. Percy invited them all into the bar. By the time Hugh Delamere limped into the bar on the leg that had been chewed years ago by a lion, the proceedings were noisy. This was a state of affairs much to his lordship's liking. As was the case with so many English public schoolboys, Delamere enjoyed boisterous games that resulted in broken furniture and other peripheral damage. This evening he was accompanied by Colonel Penrod Ballantyne. They congratulated Leon on his prowess as a hunter, and Delamere poured him a large Talisker whisky from his private stock, which he kept under the bar. Then he challenged uncle and nephew to a game of high cockalorum, which involved a race around the large room without touching the floor. At one stage the shelves behind the bar were unable to bear his lordship's weight and collapsed in a crash of breaking bottles. Just before midnight, one of the club residents came into the bar to complain of the noise. His lordship locked him into the wine cellar for the rest of the night. A few hours later, Percy was carried feet first into the billiard room and laid on the green baize of the table. Leon reached the front seat of the truck, where he passed what remained of the night. He woke with an abominable headache.
"Good morning, Effendi." Ishmael was standing beside the truck with a steaming mug of black coffee in his hand. "I wish you a day perfumed with jasmine."
The coffee revived him sufficiently to call for Manyoro. Between them they were able to start the Vauxhall and drive down the main street to the headquarters of the Greater Lake Victoria Trading Company. Below the name on the board, some other script had recently been painted out by direct order of His Excellency the Governor. However, the writing was still legible under the single coat of paint intended to obliterate it. "By appointment to His Majesty the King of England, purveyor of fine, rare, and precious items." The uncensored text read, "Dealer in gold, diamonds, ivory carvings and curios, and all manner of natural produce, sundry goods of every description for sale. Proprietor, Mr. Ghulam Vilabji, Esquire."
The proprietor hurried to meet Leon as he entered through the front door, carrying the lesser tusk. Mr. Ghulam Velabji was a well-nourished little man with a beaming smile. "By golly, Lieutenant Courtney, for me and my humble establishment, this is a jolly great honour." "Good morning, Mr. Velabji. But I am no longer a lieutenant," Leon told him as he laid the tusk on the counter. "But you are still the greatest polo player in Africa, and I have heard that you have become a mighty shikari. What is more, I see you bring proof of that." He shouted to Mrs. Velabji at the back of the store, asking her to bring coffee and sweetmeats, then ushered Leon between rows of heavily laden shelves into his tiny cubbyhole office. A bookcase that occupied one entire wall was filled with all 22 volumes of the complete Oxford English Dictionary, a full set of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, Burke's Peerage and Gentry, and several dozen histories of the English kings, their people and language. Mr. Velabji was an ardent Anglophile, royalist and proponent of the English language. "Please be seated, kindest sir." Mrs. Velabji bustled in with the coffee tray. She was even plumper than her husband, and just as affable. When she had filled the glasses with the thick, sticky black liquid, her husband shooed her away and turned back to Leon. "Now, tell me, sahib, what is your pleasure?" "I want to sell you that tusk." Mr. Velabji thought about that for so long that Leon was becoming restless. Eventually he said, "Alack and alas, revered sahib, I will not purchase that ivory from you." Leon was startled. "Why the hell not?" he demanded. "You're an ivory dealer, are you not?" "Did I ever tell you, sahib, that I was once a horse groom, or, as we say in India, a syce, in the stables of the Maharaja of Cooch Behar? I am the utmost admirer and connoisseur of the royal game of polo and the men who play it." "Is that why you won't buy my tusk?" Leon asked. Mr. Velabji laughed. "That is fine jest, sahib. No, the reason is that if I buy that tusk, I will send it to England, to be made into the keys of a piano or carved into pretty coloured billiard balls. Then you will hate me. One day, when you are an old man, you will think back on what I did with your trophy, and you will say to yourself, 10,000 curses on the head of that infamous villain and flagitious scoundrel, Mr. Ghulam Velabji, Esquire. On the other hand, if you do not buy it, I will call down 100,000 curses on your head right now," Leon warned him. "Mr. Velabji, I need the money, and I need it badly." "Ah, money! She is like the tide of the ocean. She comes in and she goes out. But a tusk like that you will never see again in all your existence. At this moment my tide is so far out that it's over the horizon. Then, sahib, we have to find some ruse, or, as we were wont to say in Cooch Behar, some stratagem to accommodate our diverse wishes." He posed a moment longer in an attitude of deep thought, then raised one finger and touched his temple. "Eureka! I have it! You will leave the tusk with me as security, and I will loan you the money you require. You will pay me interest at 20% per annum. Then one day, when you are the most famous and renowned shikari in Africa, you will come to me and tell me, 'My dear and trusted friend, Mr. Ghulam Velabji, Esquire, I have come to repay the debt I owe you.' Then I will return your fine and magnificent tusk to you, and we will be lifelong friends until the day we die." "My dear and trusted friend, Mr. Ghulam Velabji, Esquire, I call down 10,000 blessings on your head," Leon laughed. "How much can you let me have?" "I have heard tell that the weight of that tusk is 128 pounds avoirdupois." "My God, how did you know that?" "Every living human creature in Nairobi knows it already." Mr. Velabji cocked his head to one side. "At 15 shillings a pound, I find that I am able to advance you the grand sum of 96 pounds sterling in gold sovereigns." Leon blinked. That was the most money he had ever held in his hand at one time. Before he left Mr. Velabji's shop, he made his first purchase. On one of the shelves behind the counter, he had noticed a small pile of red and yellow cardboard packets displaying the distinctive lion's head trademark of Kainach, the preeminent manufacturer of cartridges in Britain. When he examined the boxes closely, he was delighted to discover that they were marked H&H 0.470 Royal Nitro Express 500 Grain Solid. Of the 10 cartridges that Verity O'Hearn had left him as part of her gift, only 3 remained. He had fired 5 shots to check the sights on the rifle, and 2 more to dispatch the great bull. "How much are those bullets, Mr. Volubji?" he inquired with trepidation, and gulped at the reply. "For you, Sahib, and for you only. I will make my very best and extra special price." He gazed up at the ceiling, as though seeking inspiration from Kali, Ganesh, and all the other Hindu gods. Then he said, "For you, Sahib, the price is 5 shillings for each bullet." There were 10 packets, each containing 5 rounds. Leon did a quick mental calculation, and the result appalled him. £12, 10 shillings? He touched the heavy bulge in his hip pocket. "I can't afford it," he told himself. "On the other hand," he answered, "what kind of professional hunter goes out into the blue with only 3 cartridges in his belt?" Reluctantly, he reached into his pocket and brought out the canvas bank bag he had so recently deposited there. The tide of his fortune had come in all right, but just as rapidly it had started to ebb as Mr. Volubji had warned him it would. Manyoro and Ishmael were still waiting outside the front of the store. Leon paid them the wages he owed them. "What are you going to do with all that money?" he asked Manyoro. "I shall buy 3 cows. What else, Bwana?" Manyoro shook his head at such a foolish question. To a Maasai, cattle were the only real wealth. "What about you, Ishmael?" "I am going to send it to my wives in Mombasa, Effendi." Ishmael had 6, the maximum that the prophet allowed, and they were as voracious as a swarm of locusts. Leon drove to the KAR barracks with Ishmael and Manyoro. He found Bobby Sampson moping over a tankard of beer in the officer's mess. His friend brightened when he saw him and cheered up so much when Leon paid him the 15 guineas he owed him for the Vauxhall that he bought him a beer. From the barracks, Leon drove out to the stockyards on the outskirts of the town. "Manyoro, I wish to send a cow to Lucima Mama to thank her for her help in the matter of the elephant." "Such a gift is customary, Bwana," Manyoro agreed. "Nobody is a finer judge of cattle than you, Manyoro." "That is true, Bwana." "When you have chosen your own beasts, pick one out for Lucima Mama and strike a price with the seller." That cost Leon another £15, for Manyoro selected the best animal in the yard. Before Manyoro set off to return to Lonsonio Mountain, Leon gave him a canvas bag of silver shillings. "This is for Loikot. If he keeps talking to his friends and brings the news to us, there will be many more bags of shillings. Tell him to save all his money, and soon he will have enough to buy himself a fine cow. Now go, Manyoro, and return swiftly. Bwana Samawati has much work for us to do." Driving the cows ahead of him, Manyoro took the rutted track that led down into the Rift Valley. When he reached the first bend, he turned and shouted back to Leon, "Wait for me, my brother, for I shall return in 10 days' time." Leon drove back to the club to pick up Percy Phillips. He found him slumped in one of the armchairs on the wide stoop overlooking the sun-parched lawns. He was in a foul mood. His eyes were bloodshot, his beard was in disarray, and his face as wrinkled as the khaki bush jacket in which he had passed the night. "Where the hell have you been?" he growled at Leon, and without waiting for an answer, stumped down the steps to where the truck was rumbling and coughing blue exhaust smoke. His expression lightened a little when he saw the tusk on which Ishmael was sitting. "Well, thank the Lord you've still got that. What happened to the other?" "We sold it to the infidel Volubji, Effendi." Ishmael had got into the habit of referring to his master in the royal plural. "That rogue! I bet he diddled you," Percy said, and climbed into the front seat. He did not speak again until they were bumping down the final and worst section of the track back into Tundala camp. "I managed to have a few words with your Uncle Penrod last evening. He had received a cable from the American State Department. The former President of the United States of America and his entire entourage will be arriving in Mombasa in 2 months' time, aboard the luxury German steamship Admiral, to begin the Grand Safari. We must be ready for them."
When they parked in front of the mess tent, Percy shouted for tea to be brought. Two mugs of the brew restored his sense of well-being and good humour.
"Get out your pencil and notebook," he ordered Leon.
"I don't possess either.
In future they will be your most essential items of equipment. Even more so than your rifle and quinine bottle. I have spares in my library. You can replace them when you next go into town."
He sent one of the servants to fetch them, and soon Leon's pencil was poised over the first page.
"Now, here is a broad picture of what this safari will involve. Apart from the President, there will be his son, a lad of about the same age as you, and his guests, Sir Alfred Pease, Lord Cranworth, and Frederick Saluce."
"Saluce?" Leon exclaimed. "He's an African legend. I was weaned on his books. But he must be ancient."
"Not at all," Percy snapped. "I doubt he's even 65 yet."
Leon was about to point out that 65 was older than ancient when he saw Percy's forbidding gaze. He understood that with Percy Phillips, age was a sensitive subject, and retreated from the minefield into which he had been about to blunder.
"Oh, then he is still quite young," he said hastily.
Percy nodded and went on.
"The President has taken on 5 white hunters, other than myself. The ones I know well are Judd, Cunningham, and Tarleton. All fine fellows. I suppose they'll have their apprentices with them. I understand from Penrod that there'll be more than 20 naturalists and taxidermists from the Smithsonian Institute, the museum that is partially sponsoring the safari. I asked Penrod about journalists and other members of the press, but he tells me that the President has forbidden their presence. After 2 full terms in office, he has come to value his privacy."
"So there will be no journalists?" Leon looked up from the notebook.
"Ha ha! Don't worry about that. No one of any note can ever get away from those cockroaches. American Associated Press is sending out a plague of them. But they will be in a separate safari that will shadow ours closely all the way, sending back copy to New York at every opportunity. A pox on all their houses."
"That means our safari will be a party of more than 30 people. There will be a small mountain of baggage, equipment and supplies to deal with."
"Indeed," Percy agreed sarcastically. "The initial estimate from New York is that they will be shipping out about 96 tons. The rest will be purchased locally. That will include 5 tons of salt to preserve the specimens and trophies and fodder for the horses. The shipment from America will be sent ahead of the main party, which will give us time to bring it up from the coast and have it broken down into 60-pound packs for the porters."
"How many mounts will they need?" Leon asked with interest.
"They intend to do much of the hunting on horseback. The President wants a string of at least 30, Percy answered. "That is one of your fields of expertise, so among your other duties I am putting you in charge of the horse lines. You will have to recruit a team of reliable syces to take care of them." He paused. "And, of course, the 2 trucks will also be your responsibility. I want to use them for resupply of small items to where the President has camped at any time."
2 motors?
You have only 1. I am commandeering the other vehicle from you for the duration of the safari. You better make sure that both are in good running order."
Percy made no mention of remuneration for the use of Leon's truck, or for the cost of repairs to get it back on 4 wheels and induce them to turn.
"Lord Delamere is lending us his chef from the Norfolk Hotel. There'll be 4 or 5 sous chefs. I'll sign on your man Ishmael to work in the camp kitchens. Oh, by the way, Cunningham will be recruiting around 1,000 native porters to carry the baggage and provisions for the safari. I told him last night that you were fluent in Kiswahili, and that you'd be happy to help him with the job."
"Did you mention that I would also be pleased to help him with the actual hunting?" Leon asked innocently.
Percy raised 1 beetling grey eyebrow. "Would you now? Given your vast experience, I'm sure the President would be honoured to have you as a guide. However, you will have many more important duties to keep you entertained, young fellow."
That particular form of address was beginning to irritate Leon, but he had decided that that was why Percy employed it so frequently.
"You're absolutely right, sir. I hadn't thought of that." And he gave Percy his most winning smile.
Percy had difficulty preventing himself smiling back. He liked it more and more that the lad could take what he handed out without whining. He relented. There'll be well over 1,000 mouths to feed. Under the game laws of the colony, buffalo are classed as vermin. There is no limit on the numbers that can be shot. One of your jobs will be to keep the safari in meat. You will have all the hunting your heart could desire, that I promise.